Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call this meeting of the Academic Research and Student Affairs Committee to order. Winter, could you please call the roll?
Chair Geddes.
Here.
Vice Chair Carter. Regent McAdoo.
Here.
Regent Perkins.
Here.
Regent Trachok. You have a quorum.
Thank you. We will go to item number one, public comment. We have no public comment. We'll go to item number two, consent items. Do I have a motion for approval of the consent agenda?
I think this is an ARSA.
Motion from Regent Perkins.
This is the whole thing, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's all one Blue Chains meeting.
Okay. Second from Regent McAdoo.
Not sure. If they're just not, maybe that's
questions or comments on the consent agenda?
Yeah.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Item number three, Nevada State College Program Proposal, BA and BS Interdisciplinary Data Science.
Good morning, Regents. For the record, Dr. Vicki Shields, Provost and Executive Vice President at Nevada State College. Today, I'm seeking ARSA approval for the combined BA and BS degree in interdisciplinary data science. This degree will provide students with the knowledge and skills needed to thrive in a world where data and information are more abundant than ever. As the world of information continues to expand from smart televisions to autonomous vehicles, the ability to understand, analyze, and visualize data will have a growing importance in the variety of careers. At Nevada State College, we are taking a student and workforce-centered approach to the information tech careers that are needed in almost any industry. Data science is the weaving together of data analysis, critical thinking, and programming skills to pursue questions and solve problems in virtually any field. Data science is being used by sociologists to understand human interactions, by biologists to understand the human genome, and by business to understand consumer behaviors. It is increasingly important in fields ranging from healthcare to professional sports. Students who graduate from Nevada State's program will be well-versed in data management and analysis, but also will possess the ability to create data reports and visualizations that can help other stakeholders understand complex information and make evidence-based decisions. The data science program will be located in a newly formed Department of Data, Media, and Design. Recognizing the importance for data scientists to possess strong critical thinking abilities, as well as communication and management skills for employability and long-term career success. We plan to launch interdisciplinary data science with two separate but interrelated degrees, a Bachelor of Arts and a Bachelor of Science, to give students more flexibility in their pursuit of a career. All students will complete a liberal arts curriculum, including studies in humanities, social sciences, and business. The BA degree is designed for students who intend to enter the job market immediately upon graduation and to improve access for various student populations through more flexible requirements in math and statistics while providing a foundation for a promising career path in the field. The BS degree is better suited for students who are considering more technical career paths or graduate school. The expanded mathematical and statistical knowledge in the BS allows them to more easily move into research positions or other opportunities that require specialized knowledge, such as work with machine learning and advanced artificial intelligence applications. Comprehensive data, such as those provided by the 2018 Workforce Blueprint by LVGEA, suggests an increasing need for employees who are skilled in the analysis and interpretation of data. Out of hundreds of position types, market analyst and management analyst were 11th and 13th on their list of Nevada high demand jobs. Likewise, conversations with industry leaders from Switch, MGM, and Southern Nevada Health District suggest a growing demand for individuals with the data science experience offered by this degree and a desire to produce these individuals within our own state. Relative to homegrown employees, they contend that the cost of attracting out-of-state employees is higher and the retention rate is lower. We predict the following growth of the program by unduplicated headcount: 20 in the first fall semester, 60 in the third fall semester, and 120 in the fifth fall semester. These figures reflect the combined total of the headcount for the BA degree and the BS degree. These totals are estimated based on presumed demand for the program, which is expected to be strong given the career opportunities enabled by a degree in this field. The budget projections you have in front of you also reflect the expenditures and revenues of the two degrees combined. In the 2017 legislative session, Nevada State received capacity building enhancement funds to launch this program in this biennium. If additional enhancement funds from the state are not forthcoming, we will rely on standard state funding to establish and grow the program. The prescribed tuition and projected enrollment suggests that it should be a priority investment for the college. I'd be happy to address any questions or take any comments.
Do I have a motion for approval?
Mr. Chair, if I may, Laura Perkins.
Yes.
Who do I notify if I have questions?
Ask your questions.
Thank you, sir. Is this program readily transferable? Like if the student wants to pursue like a master's, how does this feed into that program?
Absolutely. And it's very interesting because UNLV will be bringing in the next meeting a master's in data science and data analysis. And so we were just talking in AAC yesterday about how transferable those students can move from one to the next.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I will take that as a motion from Regent Perkins to approve.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Second from Regent McAdoo.
Yes.
Regent McAdoo, did you have any questions or comments?
I do not have any questions or comments, but I'm pleased to second the motion. Thank you.
Thank you. We have a motion and a second. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously.
Thank you.
We're going to skip over item four and come back to it later. We will now go to item number five, UNR program proposal, BS Psychology. Provost Carmen.
Thank you, Chair Gaze. Kevin Carmen, Executive Vice President and Provost of the University of Nevada, Reno, for the record. We have a proposal for a BS, Bachelor of Science degree in psychology. Psychology writ large is our largest major on campus at the university. Second behind that is biology. The psychology department recently moved from College of Liberal Arts to the College of Science, and the department has long aspired to have a Bachelor of Science degree to complement their Bachelor of Arts degree. The Bachelor of Science degree differs from the Bachelor of Arts primarily in that it is more mathematics-based, it requires calculus, and it is more research-based as well. This is a major that will be popular with many students who seek to go on to medical school, many of which require calculus, and will also provide a track for moving on to graduate school in brain science and neuroscience. I'll be brief with that proposal. I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions, Regent Perkins?
How did you know, Mr. Chair? actually, just a comment. I wanted to say thank you for the continuum that was listed, the coordination and continuum with the community colleges, because it showed like a whole line if you start off at community college and go all the way through. So I really appreciate that. And we need that type of coordination and continuum to better serve our students. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Regent Perkins. We've worked hard to make sure that all of our degree programs are well coordinated with our community colleges.
Regent McAdoo?
I make a motion for approval.
Motion from Regent McAdoo, second from Regent Perkins. Any further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Item number six, UNR program proposal, MS Kinesiology, Provost Carmen.
Thank you, Chair Geddes. Again, Kevin Carmen, Executive Vice President and Provost, University of Nevada, Reno, for the record. And again, I'll be brief, but we are proposing a Master of Science in Kinesiology. Our kinesiology major resides within our School of Community Health Sciences, and we launched our undergraduate kinesiology degree program a few years ago, and it has quickly become extremely popular. Of the 2,100 students who are majoring in the School of Community Health Sciences, approximately a third of them are majoring in kinesiology. So it's been a very successful degree program. The Master of Science program in kinesiology is a logical progression for many of those students who wish to go on to professional programs. Many kinesiology majors seek to go on in the field of physical therapy. And sometimes that additional master's degree makes them more competitive in what is already an extremely competitive field in order to get admission into those professional programs. So this will undoubtedly be a very popular program, and I seek your approval.
Questions, comments, motion?
I want to make a comment, and then I will motion. I agree wholeheartedly that this is a program that is really needed so that we can advance more physical therapists and other professions in our community, take care of the health care needs, our state, I should say. So I would like to move for acceptance of this, please.
Second. Motion from Regent McAdoo, second from Regent Perkins. Any other questions or comments? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously.
Thank you.
And to your earlier question, Regent Perkins, either raise your hand or text winner, and I will get you in the queue. But either works.
Thank you.
We're now going to item number seven, handbook revision, program enrollment prohibition, Vice Chancellor Abba.
For the record, Crystal Abba, Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs. Before you, you have a briefing paper and policy proposal concerning a program enrollment prohibition. You will recall from the June meeting, this committee, when considering the UNR PhD in engineering education, there was a statement made that students had already been enrolled in the program. That actually was not the case, and the record was later corrected. However, as a result of that, the committee requested that the board policy be quite clear in indicating that students could not be accepted or enrolled into programs until a program had been formally approved by the Board of Regents. And technically, that approval occurs with the approval of the chair's report. So this committee makes a recommendation. That recommendation is documented in the chair's report that then goes to the board for approval, as you know, on the main board agenda. So with that, I would refer you to page 3 of the reference material, and there you'll see that we are revising Title IV, Chapter 14, Section 7, and adding a simple statement indicating that students cannot be accepted or enrolled into a program until it is formally approved by the board. This proposal has been reviewed and is fully supported by the academic officers. So with that, I would be happy to answer any questions and request your approval of the handbook revision.
Do I have a motion for approval? Motion from Regent Perkins, second from Regent McAdoo. Any other questions or comments? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously.
Thank you.
Item number 8, 2018-2019 NISHE Financial Aid Report, assisted by Chancellor Davis.
Good morning, everyone. Renee Davis, NSHE Assistant Vice Chancellor and Director of Student Affairs, here to present the NSHE Financial Aid Report for academic year 2018-19. As most of you know, this report is brought to the board And we normally focus on a high-level summary of the data regarding disbursements made to NC students during the reporting year. I'll do a little bit of that this time, but I also want to shift the focus more to financial aid and how it works so that board members will have some information that they can refer to as they work and speak with students at times. So with that, could I have the next slide, please? And then one more advance to the next slide. So this slide is something that I include every year in one format or another, and it's something that bears repeating. Why report on financial aid? At its fundamental core, financial aid, the purpose of financial aid is to make sure no student is denied a college education due to the inability to pay for it. So for that purpose alone, we should always be talking about financial aid and keep that discussion at the forefront. In addition, and just as important, the presence of financial aid and the availability for our students is a cornerstone upon which three of the board's five strategic goals are built: access, success, close the achievement gap. Those all need financial aid so that we can accomplish those goals. In addition, we have some board policy requirements in the handbook for some reporting that is also done as part of this overall report. And of course, there's this changing national landscape that we always do well to keep track of. So those are the reasons we talk about financial aid, and now I'll start to get into the details. Next slide, please. So this is typically the first slide, and it just is simply a total of all financial aid disbursed to NC students during the reporting period. You'll see that the total for 2018-19 was $638.3 million. That's a 2.5 increase over the prior reporting year, 2017-18, and about a 5% increase over the last five-year period. Next slide. This is simply a breakdown by institution of that same information, and you have a five-year range there. Now, when we look at these figures, we can see clearly that GBC had the highest increase in both the one-year and the five-year period. UNLV, UNR, and Nevada State College each saw a substantial increase over the five-year period and a more modest increase over the last year. However, CSN, TMCC, and Western, this is probably going to stick out quite clearly, all saw substantial decreases between 14-15 and 2018-19. Now, I probably don't have to tell you that it's difficult to pin down a single cause of these changes, but I can talk about some basic contributing factors. So at CSN, beginning in the 15-16 award year, the institution made some major changes in the way they prepackage loans. So they used to offer the maximum to students in the prior years, and they changed so that they would only offer the subsidized loan portion, which essentially cut their the loans that were accepted by students by almost 50%. And there is some more detail in the appendix of the report, and if you have questions about some of those details, feel free to get in touch and I can provide you with a little bit longer. Now, TMCC, the story's a little different, although they also, along with Western, have been working with their students on financial literacy over the last many years. And so that has really been felt in a reduction in the student loans that students have been requesting. In addition, at TMCC, there was kind of a decline in FAFSA filers corresponding with some changes in enrollment. So not a big surprise that there are some decreases there. And then in Western, similar to TMCC, but with the additional factor of a shifting enrollment, focusing on more high school students who, of course, cannot file the FAFSA. So there's less financial aid going out, even though their enrollment is fairly steady. So that's kind of the story on those changes. And I think the silver lining is it's not all bad news. When you see that number go down, if it's loan disbursements going down, that actually could be good news. So that's pretty much all I wanted to say about that slide. So we'll move on to the next one, please. Okay, so this slide, I just wanted to take a minute to talk about the distribution of aid to our students and their race, ethnicity, backgrounds. And so you'll see just a bunch of percentages here, and you can see if you've been around for a while and seen this report, you know these numbers are pretty consistent with the distribution on the campus in the overall population. And I think that's really an important point that our institutions are making sure that the aid is dispersed widely to all of the students' populations. Next slide, please. One of the biggest programs that people are very aware of, and this is the one of the big reasons students fill out the FAFSA, is the Pell Grant. And the Pell Grant is a federal aid program that goes to the neediest of students based on the data provided on the FAFSA. In 2018-19, the maximum award was $6,095, sorry about that. And nationally, $21 billion in aid went to students. So what I try to convey in this slide is that there is an average award amount, which is typically less, quite a bit less than the maximum award. And that's because the Pell Grant award is prorated for two reasons. One is based on enrollment, and the other is based on the need of the student. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later in this presentation. Next slide, please.
You want one of these?
Oh,
yeah.
Hold on. Sorry.
So
anybody who's not Renee Davis, please mute your microphone. Anybody who's not Renee, please mute your microphone. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Geddes. And so the next slide talks about the total loan disbursements. And here is what I referred to a little earlier, which is for the most part, there has been a reduction since 2014-15. And then since then, it's been fairly flat. Some have gone up, some have gone down, but overall across NSHE, the loans are not really increasing total. So that's, again, a good thing to be looking at. The loan programs are there to assist students as they need it, and they serve a very good purpose. But our campuses are all very interested in making sure students are conservative in their borrowing habits, in particular students at the community colleges, so that they have access to loans later on in their academic careers, either finishing a bachelor's degree or moving on to graduate school. So I always like to focus on that, because it's loans themselves are not bad. They really do fill a role, but it's important to be that our students are educated about how to best use them. So next slide, please. For 2018-19, this is the list of our state financial aid programs. As you can see, there are some familiar and some new programs there. So familiar, the Governor Gwynne Millennium Scholarship, of course, that program has been with us since 2000. It was approved by the legislature in 1999. The Silver State Opportunity Grant was approved by the legislature in 2015, and the Nevada Promise Scholarship, the first awards were made in this reporting year, 2018-19. Those are the three formal statewide programs. In addition, there's the Regent Service Program, which is established in board policy, as well as what's officially called the Regent's Higher Education Opportunity Award, but others may know it as Access Aid. So that one is a big category. it's combined between money from the state-supported operating budget that's set aside by the campuses, as well as a set aside from tuition that is provided for in board policy. And then also there's a general grant and aid category. I talked a little bit in detail last year about this, and that is something of a catch-all of different kinds of awards that are made, including things like funding for student graduate assistance, athletes, those types of things. As I said, it's a broad category, and it comes from state funds, as well as there are other funding from year to year that are mixed in with that. So that's the list of programs that are statewide, essentially. And as you know, two of those programs I mentioned are limited either to just the community colleges, which is Nevada Promise, and then Silver State Opportunity Grant is at the community colleges and Nevada State College. Next slide, please. Okay, so I can see that my time is running a little short, so I'll try to do my best to cover these next slides. Let me just say that I'm always available to all of you if you have questions about financial aid, how financial aid works, how our Nevada programs work, and then also I can always put you in touch with the campuses for more specific campus-based information. So please know that I'm available to all of you. So for the financial aid basics, I did want to talk about some concepts and some categories that I typically report on the financial aid report. So when it comes to financial aid, I'm going to address category, source, type, and then cost of attendance, which is sometimes a very confusing concept for non-financial aid experts to understand. And then I'll talk a little bit about the FAFSA and the what results from filling out the FAFSA. So next slide, please. So this is probably not news to you, but I always like to start out with this. There are four basic categories of financial aid grants. These are generally need-based award, although not always. They're not paid back. Loans can be need or non-need-based. They are paid back after graduation. There are some opportunities, depending upon the loan program, for loan forgiveness, and those are often tied to employment after graduation and in serving high-need communities or high-need professions. Work-study is generally need-based. It's packaged as part of the financial aid award, but it's earned as wages throughout the academic year. So students get a paycheck, but it is part of their financial aid award. And then scholarships are merit-based awards. Sometimes there's a need component. They're not paid back. As I said, some may require need. Next slide, please. And this is a slide that appears every year in the financial aid report. And in this presentation, just wanted to give you kind of a picture of what the breakdown looks like. You can see that about 43% of the aid dispersed to students in 18-19 was loans. That's a decrease from 49%. So that piece of the pie is decreasing as others increase, and that would include in categories such as grants where we're seeing, and scholarships where we're seeing more state aid come to students. So that's a good trend to see. Next slide. And then the sources of aid, again, this is pretty basic, but it's worth mentioning. The federal government, we've talked about the Pell Grant. There's also another grant called the Federal Supplemental Opportunity Grant, a TEACH grant, and then, of course, the direct loans that you're all aware of. Those all are funded by the federal government. The state, I already ran through those programs, so I won't repeat that. Institutional aid, again, just want to mention that what we report as Regents Higher Education Opportunity Award is the Student Access Aid. And, of course, there are many various scholarships, grants, and loans awarded at the institutional level, some from state funds, but a lot from funds that are donated to the institution and are managed by the foundations. And then private aid comes in, there are various scholarships, grants, and loans that come in from outside entities. Next slide. And this is a breakdown of the source, and you can see that 63.1% of the aid coming in to NSHE students is federal still, but it is, has, again, that piece of the pie has decreased substantially since 2014-15. Next slide. So the most important concept I think about financial aid is to understand the difference between need and non-need. So in order to determine a student's need, it's of course goes beyond a student saying, I need some assistance. There's usually an application or tool used to determine the need. So for the majority of the aid awarded at all of our institutions, that tool is the FAFSA, the Free Application for Federal Student Aid. There are also, there's an associated methodology for determining need that is used when the data from the FAFSA is processed. And again, that methodology is the most common method that is used by our campuses in awarding need, need-based aid, I should say. And the categories include all four that I discussed, and I kind of list them in the order of occurrence. So grants are the most commonly need-based. Non-need, there may be some other types of criteria that apply. Scholarships is the biggest example of the non-need category, but there also could be other types of aid that are not based on need, they are based on other factors. Next slide. Cost of attendance is a federally regulated term, and it's made up of components that are listed in the regulation. And this is one of the few areas, this is just a little trivia question or trivia answer, which is this is one of the few areas that the U.S. Department of Education is not allowed to regulate. It's defined in the federal regulation, but there's no policy established around it by the U.S. Department of Education. Instead, based on the actual regulation, campuses are charged with determining the cost of attendance using these established categories. And there's always going to be a difference. There are going to be at least three different cost of attendance values that are used annually by campuses based on housing status. So it's either off campus, on campus, or with parent. And that's what the value there is retrieved from the FAFSA data, so that whatever the student says when they file the FAFSA, that is used to base this budget. And so for cost of attendance, it's used really in awarding virtually all aid, not just federal aid. And I'll talk about that in just a second. Next slide. So you're all familiar with this. I will not spend any time on it at all, which is the Free Application for Federal Student Aid is an online application, and it comes out every year. It is administered by the U.S. Department of Education. Next slide, please. So the elements of federal methodology are the EFC, the estimated family contribution, which is calculated based on the data on the FAFSA, again by the federal government, and then cost of attendance. So when student need is calculated, it's basically, at its simplest level, cost of attendance minus the estimated family contribution. That's the student's need. And in order to determine if a student has unmet need, you take the cost of attendance, subtract the estimated family contribution, and then also subtract the total aid received. So when we talk about remaining need or unmet need, it's after the student's contribution or the family's contribution and after other aid received. Next slide. So here's an example of some offer letters. And I had to make them pretty basic so that I could fit them on the slides, but it's a pretty good example of what things might look like absent the additional information about, with details about the actual award. So they're, the letter that the student would see obviously is going to be much more detailed, but this, I just wanted to show you the calculation, two examples of what I just outlined. So the example on the left is for the four-year institution. This is a lower need student. So you can see that at UNLV for 2021, the cost of attendance is set at $27,430. This is an off-campus student. And this student came in with an EFC of $14,405. Now, essentially, that means that by the calculation from the FAFSA data, the student's family can contribute that much towards the cost of their education. But remember, we're talking about the total cost of attendance. We're not talking just about the registration fees and other mandatory fees. And so when you do that first calculation, they still have, even though they have a relatively high EFC, they have a need still of $13,000. And then if you subtract to the remaining, the aid that they received, the Governor Gwynn Millennium Scholarship, and an internal and external scholarship, they still have some remaining need that could be filled with a loan. Now, at the universities, the student would be offered a loan up front in most cases to cover that remaining need. And the example on the right, which is a two-year institution higher need student, you can see we started with a $25,000 cost of attendance. The student has a zero EFC, which means that the family really is not in a position to contribute towards the cost of attendance. And then you subtract a full Pell, that other federal grant I was telling you about, the FSEOG. And then this student, we assumed, was receiving the Silver State Opportunity Grant and Millennium Scholarship. But you can see, even though they had a pretty good aid package, there's still substantial remaining need. And this just is an important concept to understand in terms of how the awards are made and how need is determined, and the fact that it's very important to look at the full picture for students, because if a student has a very large amount of unmet need, then that means that they may be taking on extra hours of work, which could interfere with their study. So it's always a balancing act, trying to figure out what can the student contribute and what is necessary to keep them on track as they pursue their studies. Next slide, please. So I know that I'm out of time, Regent Geddes, so I apologize for running long. I won't spend a lot of time on the FAFSA process. I think some of you are already familiar with it, but there are many ways that we can convey that information to you. So I'm going to go ahead and skip the slide 20. Next slide. And this is just a little list of some of the general requirements students must meet to qualify for aid through the FAFSA process. Next slide. And that brings me to the end. I'm sorry to be a little rushed there towards the end, but I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions or comments from the committee members? Seeing, hearing none. Thank you very much, Renee. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Now we'll go to item number 9, co-requisite action plan and handbook revision. Vice Chancellor Abba, Assistant Vice Chancellor McCoy.
Thank you for the record, Crystal Abba, Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs. I just wanted to quickly kick this item off and then I will turn it over to James. As you know, because we've been giving you reports at every ARSA meeting in terms of where we are with respect to implementation of the co-requisite mandate, where we have committed to the board based on your policy requirement that we have full-scale implementation by fall of 21. So now we're at fall of 20. We have spent the last year working with an implementation team and coordinating the institutions across the system so that there can be some consistency in key areas. And one piece, again, before I turn this over to James, that I wanted to articulate to the committee is the role of the system office. And the best analogy that I've been able to come up with, because as you're aware, because I said this several times before, this is not an area that the system office has a lot of prowess in, because it's one of the first times that we have ever been involved in institution level implementation for a project of this scale. We're always involved in drafting procedures that support policies adopted by the board that aid institutions in implementation, but this takes it to a new level as we're looking at areas from advising to enrollment enforcement, common pathways, placement for students that require remediation, and it has been challenging to say the least. Also, part of being incredibly challenging is that coming to this point where we actually do have consensus on some very big items in the presentation of part one, it's also incredibly gratifying. But the role of the system office, I would think of it as a spoke and hub type system where James is at the center of that hub. And James is having all of these conversations with the institutions, and it's not possible to bring in, you know, registrars, advisors, all the faculty that are needed to have this conversation in one place. So he's having multiple conversations all the time, and he's aware of the challenges that each group is having. And as one makes a decision that impacts another group, he acts as that conduit in between. And of course, during the course of that, he and I are in constant conversations. And one of the things we are continually focused on is ensuring equity in the funding formula. So that concerns key decisions like credit load for these courses as they move forward. As we present this to you today, there are two items that we will be requesting approval on. One, of course, is part one of the act, and the second piece will be a policy revision that was requested by the task force that actually aligns with the previous gateway policy. So with that, I'm very proud of this work, and I would just like to publicly say thank you to James. This is a full-time job that he has, and thank God for the grants from Strong Start to Finish and ECMC, because we couldn't do this work without the resources that James brings to the position. James, I will turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you, Vice Chancellor Abba. And Chair Geddes, James McCoy, for the record, Assistant Vice Chancellor for Academic Student Affairs and Director of Prerequisite Implementation. And Chair Geddes and ARSA committee members, I am joined today live also by the lead authors of each of the sections of this action plan. And so as we go, and you'll hear from them in a recorded video in just a moment, but as we go, if you have any questions for any of them, by all means, they are ready to answer your questions, as am I. And certainly we'll reserve some time at the end to address any questions you have as well. As Vice Chancellor Abba mentioned, there are three items included in your reference materials on this particular topic. One is part one of the action plan. Two is this PowerPoint you're looking at now. And three is the policy revision request along with the briefing paper. So we'll go through each of those items fairly succinctly today. So with that, next slide, please. So an overview today, our goal is to reemphasize exactly what Vice Chancellor Abba indicated, and this has truly been a collaborative effort across the entire system, moving what would, as you all know, when we started talking about the dismantling of an archaic remedial education system in place of something that's certainly much more student-friendly and student-focused and student-success-oriented. It is literally moving a mountain. It is literally blowing up the history of developmental education in this state, as is happening, as you know, in other states, and rethinking with quite a bit of innovation and with an equity lens how we can ensure students are truly getting through their gateway math and English experience, and perhaps more importantly, as that being the gateway to their completion of their college degrees and certificates and ultimately leading into their careers. So it has been a monumental task, and the point I'm trying to make in terms of the collaboration effort that you'll see as a constant theme throughout our dialogue today is that there were many reasons why we probably could have just put this aside. You know, we've got to, and our, they say this world pandemic that is approaching us, the social injustices of the world, all kinds of political banter. And our faculty are tired, right? Our staff are tired, working from home. There's just a myriad of reasons why this could have been asked for consideration to be put aside, but it wasn't. And it wasn't because the true focus on student success with a lens on equity, knowing that this is the right thing to do in this time, is a common theme that you'll see today. So we'll talk about part one of the prerequisite implementation action plan. I'll go over that structure in just a moment with you. And then we'll preview what is expected to be coming to you at your December ARSA committee meeting. Related to part two of the action plan. You will hear from lead authors in represented from the task force in English and in math, advising, communication and marketing, and administration. And then after that video, I will make sure I hit the highlights of each section of that action plan for you. I will not bore you with 30 some odd pages word by word, but I will certainly hit the highlights and entertain any questions you have. And then we will end with a discussion again on part two of what's to be expected from this committee or this task force, the correct task force in December at your meeting. And we will also end with our request for your approval and consideration of both part one of the action plan and two, the policy revisions that we're bringing to you today. Next slide, please. I mentioned a common theme at the front end, and I hope this visual really helps to illustrate exactly what I'm talking about here. You know, as Vice Chancellor Abba mentioned, it truly takes all voices at the table to ensure that we are doing this work correctly and with fidelity. And so, as you know, the establishment of an industry-wide co-requisite implementation task force was had. We have brought you numerous updates over the last year or so. And so I reference each of our institutions because this is a significant lift for representatives from math, from English, from advising, from registrar's offices, from provost offices, et cetera. And I just am so thankful for their diligence, for their commitment and their leadership in this work. For without it, it would, as you know, never happen. I also want to emphasize that it truly has taken a village, and it's beyond our institutions, in addition to our institutions and our system office, and that is through the financial support, both from NV Energy, as well as two major grants, as we brought to you last time. One from the ECMC Foundation, to the tune of $750,000 to support co-requisite implementation, and second is through the generous support of Strong Start to Finish, who was tied to the Education Commission of States. And they brought us a grant for $300,000. All of these dollars are going specifically to support the implementation of COREC at the institutional level, as well as to provide support in organization and professional development at the system level. And finally, as you recall, back when you were contemplating this policy and moving forward with this new way of doing developmental education and supporting students who need it the most in this way, you heard from organizations like Complete College America. And I wanted just to reference them once again, because they remain at the table, as do a myriad of other nationally recognized support structures, in helping to guide us, helping to answer our questions, helping to bring best practice from across the country. And I suspect that we will continue to see more like Complete College America join our family here in NCHE as we move into the professional development phase of this work with more structure and fidelity. Next slide, please. So, as Vice Chancellor Abba mentioned, we have broken down the action plan for implementation into two parts, a part one and a part two. We bring forward to you today, Chair Geddes and Regents on the ARCSA committee, part one. This is a reflection of the work that the state task force has accomplished to date. We fully intended pre-pandemic to have the entire action plan to you in this September ARCSA committee meeting. But obviously, due to all the nuances of our world today, we just were not ready yet. And we wanted to make sure that we had full voice and full representation in those voices. And with summer and the shift to online instruction, many of our faculty, of course, had to focus on those sorts of things. But I would be remiss to say that part one is meaty, and it has quite a bit of significant affirmation in this work. And so we'll talk about English, and we'll talk about math co-requisite. One important thing to note here is you will see some parallel similarities in both English and math in terms of the structure. One is that we have reached and continue to reach placement conversations related to how we place students into either the co-requisite English or math course or the gateway English or math course, or of course beyond if they so place higher. We are reaching more and more consistency in the context of our pathways for all kinds of students. And so you'll hear our conversations today around a liberal arts math pathway, a STEM pathway, the need for conversations around pathways for health sciences and business students that are consistent across the NCHE institutions. And same thing for English in terms of general written composition. And then finally, you'll see some commonality in the assessment of student learning, both from a learning outcomes theme standpoint, but perhaps even equally important is the desire for this task force and the disciplines within them, English and math, to come around the table very regularly to engage in continuous improvement exercises as it relates to the outcomes of their institutional assessment of student learning, as it really, again, related to co-requisite and gateway math and English. Aside from English and math, we will also hear about the faculty training that is happening, both from an adjunct faculty credentialing standpoint, as well as a full and part-time faculty training standpoint beyond and in addition to credentialing. We'll hear about the advising efforts, because obviously advising becomes the linchpin in much of this communication work with our students. We'll talk more specifically about the system-wide approach to communication. And then finally, as I alluded to earlier, we will end this part of the presentation with a preview of part two. So with that, let's go ahead and cue up the video and hear from our state task force. It's about 9 minutes long. Thank you.
My name is Elaine Bunker, Associate Director of Composition in the UNLV English Department and lead author for the English Action Plan. The English group has worked collaboratively during the past year through a combination of in-person meetings, virtual meetings, and collaborative online drafts. We reviewed placement policies in light of both NSHE policy and national best practices. The standardized test scores mandated by NSHE policy provide a useful initial assessment. So we identified other ways to assess student preparation, such as guided self-placement and student portfolios, in order to provide more equitable placement for all students. We identified unified pathways so that the English 101 curriculum is now the default first semester course at all 7 institutions, with 3 different models for delivery, depending on the institution and student need. First as a standalone 3-credit course. Second, as a 3-credit course with added support through 2 credits of labs. And third, as a 5-credit course, English 100, that has 2 credits of embedded support. In all 3 cases, common student learning outcomes ensure that the 3 pathways truly are parallel. The core learning outcomes for the Gateway course focus on 4 key areas: rhetorical knowledge, critical thinking, reading, and composing, processes, and conventions. Co-requisite support, whether offered as a co-requisite lab or embedded in English 100, focuses on critical reading strategies and editing skills. These skills are already taught within the Gateway course. The co-requisite support simply provides explicit instruction and additional coaching to assist students in meeting the core requirements of the Gateway course. We also approved a core set of shared values in order to provide reliable assessment of student achievement. These include authentic assessment based on student writing, clear links between assessment instruments and the stated course outcomes, feedback loops that use assessment results to make meaningful changes when indicated, and regular collaborative sharing of assessment results. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Good morning. Anne Flesher, Dean of the Math and Physical Sciences Division at TMCC, previously the Vice Chair of the Math Department and Faculty Senate Chair. I have been a part of the NSHE Co-Requisite Task Force since it formed. Part one of this action plan provides an overview of the key outcomes. Last September, the task force agreed to a central goal of discipline-specific implementation. With respect to placement, we have reached some common ground. Each institution already honors the Board of Regents handbook, which states that a student with any of the measures listed in the handbook must be placed into a college-level math class, that being at least Math 120 without support. We are still in the process of moving towards greater consistency in placement for all our Gateway math classes. For the pathways, the primary focus was on a liberal arts pathway with Math 120 and a STEM pathway with Math 126. Institutions are open to exploring other pathways, but given the time frame, it was best to work on these two first. All institutions have agreed that Math 120 with support is an open enrollment class, an open pathway for a liberal arts degree. Math 126 with support varies at this time. The task force agreed we would continue these discussions regarding the inconsistency and report back in December, now that our faculty have returned from summer break. We found many common themes with respect to our student learning outcomes. Each institution will already follow the assessment cycle within their college. In addition, we agreed to meet annually to discuss available assessment results as a means for continuous improvement across the system. Thank you.
For the record, I'm Laurel Pritchard, Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education at UNLV. I serve as UNLV's administrative representative to the NSHE Co-Requisite Implementation Task Force. Over the past year, the administrator group has focused on a variety of issues related to co-requisite implementation, including curriculum development, professional development for faculty and staff, faculty credentialing, and some technical aspects of course scheduling. One important issue that needed to be addressed was that some faculty who have been teaching traditional remedial math courses at the two-year institutions don't have the appropriate graduate level credential to teach college level co-requisite courses. To address this issue, UNLV's Department of Mathematical Sciences will offer an 18 credit online certificate in post-secondary math education. The certificate consists of graduate math and math education courses, and we anticipate that it will be approved by our graduate curriculum committee this fall. We offered two of the courses that will be part of the certificate online this summer, and already four instructors from Great Basin College have enrolled.
Development of the certificate is supported by strong start to finish, and student registration fees are sponsored in part by grant money from the ECMC Foundation and the NV Energy Funds.
In addition to the math certificate, faculty and staff have had several opportunities to learn from national experts on co-requisite implementation. Most notably, we had the opportunity to travel to Citrus College to see co-requisite instruction in action and to learn from their faculty. We plan to offer ongoing professional development for faculty and staff, including for academic advisors, which you'll hear more about later in the presentation. Thank you for your attention, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
My name is Natalie Brown, and I'm the Executive Director of Advising and Access Services here at Truckee Meadows Community College, and the Advising Lead from TMCC on the NSHE CoREC Task Force. The Advising Leads from all of NSHE institutions have been collaborating with the Math and English Leads to develop a communication plan and system to ensure students receive the advising assistance and information they need to make a well-informed decision when it comes to math and English registration. Our NSHE advisors are all in and planning on creating a handbook to assist advisors across the state with the co-requisite implementation, along with placement and pathway information. This guidebook will be fully customizable by each institution. The advising group is also planning a summit to ensure all advisors are aware and know the appropriate placement and pathways for this new model. Given the uncertainties of the current time, the summit may be postponed to spring or planned as a virtual event this fall. We are leveraging grant funding, in particular Strong Start to Finish, to bring in content, experts, and speakers. And during the advising summit, all advisors will be provided with information on research supporting the co-requisite model, sample language designed for student-facing messaging, information on how the curriculum is designed, an overview of the various pathways, placement, and cut scores, examples of specific student situations to help advisors navigate unique situations, and examples of co-curricular support structures beyond credit courses. It is through our frontline advising staff that the strong messaging of this new co-requisite placement and pathway model will reach our students.
Hello, my name is Jennifer Sprout. I am the communications director with Great Basin College. Myself, along with Morgan Kaiser-Schott, will be leading the efforts in marketing and communication for the NSHE co-requisite. Our biggest task is creating the communications toolkit for NSHE system-wide use. The purpose of the communication toolkit is to provide NSHE institutions with communication collateral that portrays a consistent message with NSHE unified brand. We have created a logo and a color scheme for the marketing collateral. With this, in this toolkit, you'll be able to find posters, social media images and content, and of course, PowerPoints for presentations. We're creating the communication toolkit for really three audiences: students, high schools and counselors, and then of course, college campus communities as well. We will have this ready for NSHE institutions to utilize by this fall.
Great Basin College has been given money from the Strong Start to Finish grant to support the development of the co-requisite communication toolkit. Thank you.
Okay, I understand that there were a few that, or perhaps even several, that could not hear or see the video, and we apologize for that. It is included in the reference materials, and we will be sure to send it out to anybody who would like to see this separately. But the point is, I want to give thanks to the lead authors of the task force, Laurel Pritchard, Natalie Brown, Ann Flesher, Elaine Bunker, and Jennifer Sprout, who all presented on behalf of a much larger group of the implementation task force. And to really highlight the contributions that the entire task force has made. And they are all standing by for any questions at the end as well. With that, though, I do want to go over some of the major elements of that action plan. So if we can advance to the next slide, please. We'll start with English. Next slide, please. So as Elaine Bunker had indicated, for English co-requisite, it is sort of framed out into three major categories: English placement, English pathways, and English student learning assessment. On the English placement protocols, as Elaine mentioned, the standardized test scores as prescribed by ACT, noted by ACT or SAT or Smarter Balance, are already prescribed by board policy. And of course, each institution will continue to follow board policy for placement as it relates to those standardized test scores. In addition to that, there are other mechanisms for placement, and this is a really exciting component given many of the national and state conversations around equity and standardization for placement into college level or co-requisite math and English. And that is, each institution is currently exploring a myriad of different methodologies for student placement. And for English, that will include student portfolios, multiple measure variables, like things like high school GPA or how a student performed in their last English class in high school, for example. Very specific guided self-placement conversations where a student sits with an advisor and works through a myriad of cognitive and non-cognitive variables to help students place into the most appropriate experience, be that co-requisite English or right into the gateway English. Second is pathways, and as Elaine mentioned, there are three parallel pathways, and it's important to note that each of these pathways, regardless of where a student places, will get, at the completion of that course, will get them the credit they need for the gateway course. So a student very well may place right into English 101 for 3 credits. That's the gateway course. That's great. If a student requires additional support, rather than going into traditional, lists of remediation, pre-college level, student will be placed into the co-requisite course along with the gateway course. And that co-requisite component is that embedded support or those 2 extra lab credits. Again, meeting students where they are with any deficiencies they have specific to the student in their composition. And then finally, on the assessment front, just real briefly, the task force across the institutions have agreed that they will approach this with a common student learning outcome experience. That institutional assessment plans will be based on common principles, which is great, and that the task force representatives from English, among other faculty across the state within English, will gather at least once a year to review each institution's student learning outcome assessment as it relates to the co-requisite and gateway courses. Next slide, please. Here we have math, and similarly as English, we have placement, we have pathways, and we have assessment. And as I mentioned, similarly to English, the board policy prescribes standardized test scores as one mechanism for placement. But in addition to that, each institution is exploring an alternative and or additional variables or methodologies for math placement, one being ALEKS PPL. It's a diagnostic tool. Student experiences a myriad of questions related to mathematics. It right-sizes where the student's understanding is, provides specific diagnostics, and then puts them on a self-learning path, even perhaps pre gateway or co-requisite course, to self-remediate as much as possible. Ed Ready is another similar approach as ALEKS PPL is, and like English, the math faculty are exploring multiple measures and guided self-placement protocols as well. On the pathways front, as Dean Flesher has indicated from TMCC, that the system has come across, system institutions have laid out 2 major pathways with consensus. One is around liberal arts, and that is specifically aligned to Math 120 or the Math 120 co-requisite course. If a student is STEM-bound, meaning that they will ultimately need calculus, they will experience either Math 126 or the Math 126 co-requisite course. Again, that Math 126 co-requisite course is directly aligned with the Gateway Math 126 course, as is the Math 120 course aligned to the co-requisite Math 120 course. What is still up for a significant conversation in the coming weeks in preparation for your December board meeting and ultimately full implementation in the fall 21 semester is what to do with commonality for our business and health science students and what to do with Math 124. So more on that as it is developed in the coming weeks. And finally, similar to English with assessment, flexible outcomes for co-requisite courses based on the student needs. So again, the idea around co-requisite support is to meet students where they are. Unlike a traditional math course, for example, where all the learning outcomes will be predetermined. In this context, because of the diagnostic nature of understanding a student's remediation needs that are unique to them, perhaps not every student has struggles with fractions, but only those two students over on this side need help with fractions. So they will get that support with fractions. Meanwhile, over here in that support course, perhaps these students are having trouble with the quadratic equation, for example, and they will get support in that very specific space. So that tailored just-in-time support becomes very relevant in the support component of the co-requisite course. However, there is still common assessment themes overall, the gateway portion of the math co-rec courses. And just like English, the math folks have agreed to annually meet and to engage in continuous improvement conversation each year. Next slide, please. Here we have a brief overview on faculty training and the professional development. As Laurel Pritchard had indicated, we are very thrilled with UNLV for stepping up and supporting the entire system in the development of an 18 graduate credit hour certificate in mathematics secondary education. This is particularly going to be well suited for any of our adjunct faculty who are currently teaching below college level math courses at our institutions, you know, remedial, traditional remedial, Math 95, for example, who otherwise would not have the credentials necessary to teach college level. This 18 graduate credit hour certificate in mathematics will provide an opportunity for several adjunct faculty who are short in their credentialing to be able to take this year-long program and be ready to go for fall 21 to support the institution's training instructional needs. For those faculty who are certainly credentialed but could use some professional development and training in the context of co-requisite instruction, because it's a different kind of pedagogical approach, of course, it's a different approach altogether. The sort of a train-the-trainer approach will occur. The system office will be supporting much professional development for faculty in math and in English, as will each institution unique to the institution. So that's exciting. And just a quick shout out that the training in PD, by and large, is supported by NV Energy monies, as well as the two grants from Strong Start to Finish and the Foundation. Next slide, please. On the academic advising front, as Natalie Brown mentioned in the video, this is the linchpin for ensuring communication is happening between the students and the institution as it relates to how a student will experience co-requisite. And what does that mean? And why, you know, my brother took Math 95. Why is that not even on the books anymore? Those kinds of conversations, helping a student guide through the understanding of why the co-requisite course is so important if they so placed in it. To do it with good support. The INSHE Implementation Task Force has representatives in advising from each institution, and they are collectively working on a co-requisite advising guidebook. Looking forward to sharing that with the ARSA committee in December. Between now and December, they will have at least one statewide advising summit, albeit it will be virtual, but that is supported by Strong Start to Finish and ECMC grant dollars. And just a quick note that we can't overemphasize the importance of the advisor role in communicating not only with students, but also institutional communication within the advisors. Next slide, please. On the communication and marketing front, for those of you who may remember the system-wide approach to the implementation of 15 to Finish, we had a wonderful toolkit of communication mediums to share the message about what 15 to Finish was and why it was important to support a student success agenda. Similarly to that, We have developed and are currently finishing up a communication and marketing toolkit, which will ensure consistent messaging and branding across the institutions for this prerequisite work. Each institution will be able to download different types of collateral, make it their own with their own unique institutional branding, but still have consistency in the NSHE COREC branding. And this will be used for communication with students, with high school personnel, with high school counselors and teachers, with campus communities internally, and certainly externally to the world. Big shout out to the communication team at Great Basin College who are developing this toolkit on behalf of the entire system. And that is indeed supported by the Strong Start to Finish grant. Next slide, please. Just a sampling here of some of the communication collateral. You'll see the common communication branding colors there. In the middle of the screen, you'll see just a sample of some of the collateral that is being developed to really amp up this incredible shift to helping to meet students where they are with math and English early. There's social media messaging that can be plug and played, along with some logo designs and flyers, et cetera. Next slide, please. So in December, we have alluded to this being this action plan that we bring to you for approval today. The idea that we will also bring to you the remaining portion of the action plan, and that is coined as part two. So I just want to provide just a minute on a preview of what you can expect in part two and see if you have any questions on what's coming. Number one, as it was alluded to earlier, the protocols for enrollment enforcement are incredibly important. It's one thing to have a policy. It's another thing to have the institutions implement said policy, but it's an entirely different thing to add fidelity to all that work to ensure that students are actually enrolling with enforced enrollment in the co-requisite course or the gateway course. And so to ensure those things are happening at each institution, our registrars group are working feverishly on designing some enrollment enforcement protocols within the PeopleSoft environment. As you can imagine, this is a significant lift. Right now, they are contemplating three different scenarios to ensure enrollment enforcement occurs, but more on that come the December ARSA meeting. Additionally, each of our institutions are working on an analysis of human and fiscal needs for full-scale implementation. In other words, when we bring co-requisite math and English to full scale for fall of 21, do we have the human resources that are necessary to support that work, particularly as it relates to qualified and credentialed math and English faculty? So we intend, the institutions are working through an exercise literally as we speak to provide some concrete data to support a narrative for part two of the action plan that will describe indeed the human fiscal needs. Next, as we alluded to with the math presentation, there needs to be a common gateway math pathway for business and health science students across the system, which continues to be a struggle point, and it has been for business and math students across the system for decades. But with this work around co-requisite implementation, it certainly has been illuminated again, and we intend to work through that with the math and English faculty across the system. Common credit amounts for all math co-requisite courses across the community colleges and Nevada State College. This is particularly important as it relates to the outcomes of the funding formula. And finally, a statewide co-requisite assessment plan will be provided in part two, which will basically highlight what our plan is to ensure that this policy indeed is working and that students are succeeding in and through their gateway course and ultimately in and through their college degrees. Again, the impetus for this policy to begin with. So Chair Geddes, with that concludes this portion of the presentation. Before we get to the policy briefing revision request, we'd like to open it up for any questions with your permission and ask for your consideration of adoption and approval of part one of the action plan.
Thank you. And can you all hear me?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Okay. And before we get into the questions and more discussion, I just wanted everybody to be cognizant of the fact that as the group's been working on this, as we know, the math pathways for liberal arts and STEM students are long, established consistently across our institutions. The real challenge will be establishing the consistent pathway for business and health science students, which has been inconsistent across the NSHE institutions for decades. While that's the greater of the challenges, it will be a significant accomplishment for our system, and I look forward to the December report and seeing that a consistent pathway for business in health sciences has finally been achieved. And with that, are there questions or comments from the committee? Hearing none and seeing none, let's go ahead and go into the proposal, James.
You bet. Thank you, Chair Geddes. The proposal in front of you today is for a policy revision on Title IV, Chapter 16, Section 1. And this is the board's policy on co-requisite and college-ready gateway mathematics and English. And essentially, it's just this is a very minor revision at the request of the state task force and certainly held with consensus among each of the institutions. And it's essentially changes the language in subsection 2A, which will say within the first two regular academic semesters following initial enrollment, all degree-seeking students must be enrolled in a college-level or co-requisite gateway English and math course. So essentially what this does is the previous version or the current version of the policy, I should say, says upon initial enrollment, all students will be enrolled in gateway college-level or co-requisite gateway math and or English. What we want to do in this policy revision request is ask the board to consider leveling, giving the institutions an opportunity to level out that enrollment, not forcing the institutions to enroll every student in math and English upon entry, but rather over the course of the first two semesters, take care of math and English. What that'll do is a few things. Number one, and we heard this loud and clear from the institutions, for some students, they could use English or co-requisite English first before they tackle math, particularly due to the heavy reading and writing, heavy reading component of math courses. So if they can get through their English experience first and then tackle their math immediately following in the next semester, that would be number one. Number two, the reason this is important to the institutions is rather than having a significant pipeline of students all trying to take their math and English in the fall semester, for example, and then that leaves a significant void in math and English offerings in the spring. We would like to be able to level off the scheduling of courses over the fall and first fall and spring semester to ensure that we have, solid plethora of course offerings throughout the academic year. And so those are really the two reasons why this policy proposal is revision is being brought to you today. I'll stop there and ask if there are any questions.
First of all, would anybody like to make a motion to approve part one of the plan and to approve the policy revision?
Regent Perkins, so moved.
I have a motion from Regent Perkins, a second
from second.
Regent Carter. Any questions or comments on the motion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. It passes unanimously. Did anybody have any questions on what they would like to see in December? Provide James with any further direction? Hearing none? I think you're good.
Thank you, Chair Geddes.
We will go on to item number 10, the 2019 Transfer and Articulation Audit Report and Recommendations. Vice Chancellor Abba, and before I get there, I just want to say that this is something near and dear to me, as many of you have heard before. When I was in student government at UNR, one of our goals in 1989 was to get better transfer and articulation between UNR and UNLV, and our UNR and TMCC and Western, and it was a fight back in 89, and in seeing today's report, I'm very happy that we finally addressed most of the issues and have built a system that works. With that, Vice Chancellor Abba.
Thank you. For the record, Crystal Abba, Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs. I think we are right on time, so I will do my very best to keep this within the 20 minutes allotted so I don't cut into Marcy's time. Next slide, please. So what we'll cover today is the basic definitions for transfer and articulation. Then I want to talk just a little bit about a transfer degree versus a non-transferable degree. This is our third transfer audit since 2016. So within 4 years, we've done three audits. And part of the reason of doing these audits stacked on top of each other is to kind of combat that perception that there's a systemic problem with transfer and articulation. None of these audits have actually revealed that, but one of our primary goals through doing all of this has been able to continually improve on the transfer process. And I think what you're going to see from this is really a change in the culture and the attitude internally towards transfer and articulation. So this really is, as Chair Geddes indicated, this is a pretty big deal. And we've made incredible strides. And again, I'm just really proud of this work. The final piece that I'll talk about today is the request for review. As many of you will recall, that was a policy that was put into place by Chancellor Riley in 2017. And there is a regular reporting requirement in there. And I will touch base on that to meet that requirement as well. Next slide, please. Okay, so in general, The term transfer and articulation historically, especially talking with broader groups like the legislature or even board members, there was always some confusion on the use of those two terms. And sometimes they were used interchangeably, and they're really not. They have very distinct meanings. So transfer basically means that a course gets transferred to the institution. All courses within ENCHI are transferable unless they are designated in PeopleSoft in the course catalog as non-transferable. And typically non-transferable courses are vocational or community service type courses. But again, they have an indicator in PeopleSoft so that when a student registers, they see it in the course catalog, they clearly know, okay, this is a course that is not going to transfer if I move to a university or to another community college within the system. Articulation, that's the really important part. Articulation indicates whether or not that particular course will meet the degree requirement at the receiving institution. And so the key to all of that and the focus for the audits has been the transfer agreements, because the purpose of the transfer agreement basically is to provide a guide for students and obviously a tool for advisors when they advise students, so that a student who is pursuing a transferable associate's degree at a community college with the plans of transferring to a four-year institution, the goal is ultimately that the student transfer and not lose any credits along the way. And so what happens is that transferable associate's degree transfers kind of in a block, for lack of a better term. And as a result, when that student transfers to the four-year institution, they basically have junior status, and there's no expectation that they would need to go back and take any lower division major requirements. They're basically a junior, and they should be able to complete that bachelor's degree within the same period of time had they actually started at the university. And again, the key to that is good advising. And that's why those transfer agreements are so important, because it is a tool for advisors. So that your transfer degrees are your AA, AS, and AB. Non-transferable degrees, though, which I won't talk a lot about today, typically that's your Associate of Applied Science, which is, again, not designed to be a general transfer degree, and it really is intended to lead to immediate employment within the designated field. However, a lot of our AAS degrees are now stackable with a BAS degree at the community colleges, but that's kind of a separate issue that will not be addressed in this transfer audit report. Next slide, please. So let me go back to 2016 when we presented the 15-16 audit. So this was pre-Chancellor Riley. And again, what we were trying to do at that time was to dispel some of the concerns that there were systemic problems with transfer and articulation. And we knew that we were going to be doing a follow-up audit of all regional transfer agreements, but to start that off, we wanted to basically do a policy audit and make sure that we didn't have any challenges in the policy where there are issues that need to be corrected. We did. There was a conflict in the policy that was corrected. We also put in a provision that a student who transfers to a university, they could go in under the catalog that they would have started in from the year that they started at the community college. So what that basically does is it ensures that that transfer agreement that they started with is then honored. At the same time that we did that policy audit, we did a random sample of 276 transfer agreements. And again, we were auditing those transfer agreements to make sure that they were complying with board policy. Another key to this was we surveyed recently transferred students, so students who had transferred from an ENCHI community college to a university, because what we wanted to gauge was their general perception. And given the concerns about systemic problems, I was actually shocked because the results of those surveys were very positive. By and large, students said that it worked. Where the challenge was, it was a little bit of a culture shock going from kind of an insulated environment of a community college campus to a larger university setting. And sometimes I think students found that intimidating. They obviously, there were cases where they had challenges, but in general, they didn't cite the issue of transfer agreements or the articulation of general credits. And one of the positive things that came out of that 15-16 audit was we reviewed all of the protocols related to curricular changes and put into place protocols to ensure that when curricular changes occur, for example, at the university, that it flows through so that appropriate adjustments are made in the transfer agreements. So next slide, please. So following that, we did the 18-19 audit, which literally took place directly after, and we were looking at transfer agreements that aligned with the 18-19 course catalogs. And again, it was to ensure that there was compliance with board policy, and so there were three essential elements that we were looking at in the audit. Number one, was there a transfer agreement for each university degree with a corresponding transferable associate's degree at the regional community college? Was there a year-by-year course outline that students could follow? And then, of course, the absolute key to that is within the first 2 years, the way the courses were outlined, does that result in the associate's degree with no loss of credits under the four-year degree program? So again, it honors that philosophy of if you're going to transfer from a community college to a university, we don't want you to have to backtrack and take additional credits, so that you're doing that within the same number of allotted credits that you would have if you had originally started at the university. With that 18-19 audit, we reviewed 370 transfer agreements. And if we can go to the next slide, you'll see the general results of that. And this audit, by the way, was presented to the board. Next slide, please. Slide six, thank you. With that, we reviewed 370 transfer agreements. There were almost 200 that were not submitted by the deadline. So we were more stringent at that time. And as a result of the 370 that were reviewed, 76% were basically in alignment with board policy with less than three credits lost. So that outcome in and of itself was not bad. We were actually, again, it's that whole issue of where is the data that supports this perception that there's a systemic problem. At 76%, that's pretty good. But what we recommended to this committee, and they actually approved, was we wanted to do an audit immediately following that because we wanted to keep the pressure on, and really we wanted to show overall improvement. So next slide, please, slide 7. So again, the goal of the next audit was to show continuous improvement and keep the pressure on. Next slide, please, slide 8. So moving into the audit that is the primary subject of this presentation is the 19-20 audit. And again, 19-20 audit, so we were reviewing transfer agreements that came out of 19-20 course catalogs. There were 593 transfer agreements that were reviewed. And as you can imagine, in terms of staff time, it takes anywhere between 30 to 45 minutes to review an individual transfer agreement against the three criteria that I indicated. So it was about 2,700 staff hours. In the prior audit, when we did, you know, about 120 fewer transfer agreements, we were at about 1,500 hours. But it did require for both audits that we hired a temporary worker who was dedicated to working with the two full-time staff that were reviewing those transfer agreements. And that at the time was our Common Course numbering person, Janet Stake, and Dave Singleton, our transfer and articulation ombudsman, and all of that work was overseen by Director Renee Davis. Next slide, please. So one difference with the 19-20 audit was that we did have what we refer to as a correction phase. And the reason we did that was because, as we indicated to the board in the prior audit, the 18-19 audit with the 76% of transfer agreements in compliance, we were really aiming for not just improvement, but significant improvement. And as a result, when we got through the initial review, there were areas that could be corrected. And some of the corrections were simple math errors in terms of adding up some credits on a transfer agreement, or there were certain courses that we knew could be substituted and correct those transfer agreements relatively easily. So once we got the initial results from the audits, we went back to the institution and basically gave them an exception report that provided all of the transfer agreements that were not in alignment, and they were given an opportunity. We gave them about 6 weeks to resubmit and make corrections, because what we were aiming for was perfect compliance, and in some cases we did get that. And again, the total review there was 593 transfer agreements. So now I'm going to look at the regional data and present it overall as opposed to the institution to institution data, just to give you kind of the 65,000 foot view of what was accomplished by the audit. So next slide, please, slide 10. So in the southern region of the state, we were looking at transfer agreements between CSN and UNLV and CSN and Nevada State. In the initial review, there were 94 agreements that were submitted. Obviously, we were missing some. So with the final review, it was a total of 142, and 85% were in compliance with board policy. So it was a significant improvement over the prior audit. Next slide, please. In the north, better results even still, which is remarkable given the fact that there were significantly more transfer agreements that were reviewed between the four institutions. So these were agreements between GBC and UNR, GBC and WNC, TMCC and GBC, TMCC and UNR. So with that, in the initial results, 76% were in compliance, but by the time we went through the second correction phase, it was 99%. And you'll see from a review of the actual report where we break it down by institution between, I believe it was WNC and GBC, but between UNR and TMCC, which there's a constant flow there. I would consider that one of the more high traffic areas for students transferring in the north. 100% of those agreements were in compliance with board policy. So I'm just tickled. And I know Jason is too, because he's been talking about this since 1989. So moving on to slide 12, you'll see this again is just for comparison purposes. So we went from the 76% to 95.4% across those regional areas being in compliance with board policy. And we only had five agreements that were not submitted even within the correction phase. And we're working on with the institutions on those now. So with that, I would like to turn to kind of the next slide, which is the key to all of this, which is what will be our next steps. And this is basically where we're asking for your approval of the recommendations. And there are three basic recommendations. So one of the things that we discovered is that there were some cases that led to challenges where the transfer agreements didn't align because there was 300 and 400 level coursework in the first 2 years. So we basically want to clarify the board policy that upper division coursework cannot be included in the first 2 years, although, and I don't know of what would be a reasonable exception off the top of my head, there may be cases that are justifiable, but that would require a review and approval by the Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs. So generally what we're saying is we're going to do lower division coursework appropriate for associate's degrees in the first 2 years and upper division in the final 2 years. Recommendation number two is to revise board policy to clarify the use of reverse transfer for the purpose of aligning a transfer agreement. So right now we actually have a very robust reverse transfer provision in Title IV, Chapter 14 that basically provides that there's kind of a constant back and forth in terms of lists of students that have transferred to a university and they may not have gotten their associate's degree, but the community colleges can receive this list, then contact the students and with their permission do a reverse transfer so that they could achieve their associate's degree. And in some cases that might be just a general associate's degree. But we just want to clarify the policy that that is permissible. And let me give you kind of an example of where that would be appropriate. I always use the nanoscience degree. So if a university is offering a nanoscience degree, obviously that is a very specialized degree program. And so they would have the transfer agreement with the general transfer degree. So there's an opportunity there where the lower division major requirements could be completed at the university, reverse transfer to the community college for the purpose of receiving the associate's degree, and again, honoring the transfer agreement. And then the final recommendation, which kind of goes without saying, with the work of Janet and Dave, is that the system office would continue to perform ongoing monitoring and review of transfer agreements so that we know that that we maintain that 95% and eventually the 100% going forward. That's actually something that we kind of do now, but we want to do it in more of a of an established process where it becomes a regular protocol for my department. So with that, the next slide, please. As I indicated in 2017, when Chancellor Riley began his tenure, obviously he was hearing the concerns about transfer and articulation. So he put into place what we refer to as the request for review. And this typically does not get utilized for students that are transferring within the system. And the reason is if they're following the transfer agreement or under common course numbering, those courses are obviously going to transfer and articulate as appropriate. So this policy really comes more into play for a student who is transferring credits from outside the system. And so in the course of the 3 years that this policy has been in place, and again, I'm going back to that issue of where is the data that supports that systemic problem with transfer and articulation. And so this policy was a significant step in collecting that data. And the interesting thing is that over the course of the 3 years that the policy has been in place, we have had one request for review reach the system office. And when I say reach the system office, the policy requires that the student go through all the institution level appeals processes. Then it comes up to the system level. The system then coordinates a discipline review committee that looks at that. So this is faculty from the discipline across the system. They review the institutional decision to determine whether or not they agree with it. And then obviously, we're, as we've indicated to the board before, we're kind of bucking up right against accreditation standards, so we can't require that they accept it for articulation, but we can certainly tell the institutions, look, this was the finding of the discipline review committee. We would request that you, you know, go back and reconsider. So drum roll, please. How many have we had in 3 years? We just got one in 2019. Again, one. It was from a student that was transferring a course in from Arizona. For that particular course, they were requesting that it articulate to a certain course, course ABC. And based on the review of the discipline committee, they actually recommended that it not articulate to the course that the student was requesting, but it articulated to another ENSHE course. So it ended up being a positive outcome for the student. But again, it has not been a protocol that we have utilized a great deal, evident by the fact that transfer and articulation does seem to be robust and working across the system. But again, as you know, there are those anecdotal cases, which is kind of the perception that we're constantly fighting. So with that, the last slide, I would beg the committee's approval of the recommendations. If you approve the recommendations today, we will bring back the policy revisions to the December ARSA meeting with a formal policy proposal. So with that, I am happy to answer any questions.
And your specific request is to approve the three recommendations as well as the reporting requirement, or just to develop that?
The way the agenda item language is to approve the recommendations, which really in and of itself is the report. So if the motion could be to approve the recommendations and the report, that is appropriate. Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you. Do I have a motion? Regent Carter?
There we go. So the policy would come back to the board. This is just approving the report and the recommendation to recommend a policy.
That is correct.
I motion to approve that then and do that.
Thank you. I have a motion. Second from Regent McAdoo. Any other questions or comments? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Hearing none, the motion passes unanimously. Before we go to item 11, we're going to go back to item number 4, the EMCC program proposal, registered nurse, the BSN program. President Hilgerson. Or Marie, are you going to
Yes, I'm going to do that. Thank you.
Marie Mergelo, Vice President of Academic Affairs, Truckee Meadows Community College, for the record. Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to present to you for your consideration TMCC's RN to BSN degree. As you are aware, based on a recommendation of the Council of Presidents and the Chancellor, a presentation regarding this proposal was given as an information-only item at the Health Sciences Committee meeting at the March Board of Regents meeting. I'd like to highlight some of the pertinent details in this proposal and that presentation. I will focus on need, process, and students. When we look at need, we could see that there's been a very big shift in the industry. The Institute of Medicine recommended that 80% of all nurses nationally should be at the bachelor's prepared level by 2020. Well, we're well into 2020, and at this time in Nevada, there are only 55% of nurses that are bachelor's prepared. And only 20% of TMCC's current ADN graduates pursue a bachelor's degree. In addition to the need for bachelor's prepared nurses, there's also a need for ADNs. The current need is for an additional 5,000 registered nurses in the state of Nevada. That's just to meet the national average. And that equates to more than 1,000 locally. This degree is about creating a pathway for TMCC students. Our students have a comfort level with TMCC, with their professors, and with the program. We will recruit from our past graduates and our current students as they can co-enroll during their last year of their ADN program. And we will recruit from our current graduates each and every year. The program is dynamic, and it keeps nurses in the workforce while upskilling, as all classes are online and in 8-week terms. 90% of TMCC graduates stay in Nevada, and they serve our community. They are diverse, and in general, come from a lower economic background. 40 students were surveyed, and 100% of them said that they would pursue an RN to BSN degree if it were offered at TMCC. The reasons they gave included that they are familiar with TMCC. They like the continuity of the program from the one they are currently in. And they understand the expectations. Cost factors were also very important to them. And they all said that they had a very positive experience and received a top-notch education at TMCC. We want to be able to serve our students the same way that GBC serves theirs. Over the past 3 years, GBC accepted 65 applicants to their RN to BSN program, and 86% of them had been GBC associate degree graduates. Another value that this program would bring would be that once students earn their BSN at TMCC, they could then pursue a master's at the NC universities, thus providing an additional pipeline to those graduate programs. In closing, this program would provide an opportunity to fill the dire need that exists nationally and in Nevada for BSN-educated nurses, to upskill our ADN students, strengthen the pipeline of qualified healthcare workers and qualified applicants to graduate programs, keep these students in NSHE, and ultimately serving our community. This is a win-win-win. Thank you for your kind consideration of this proposal, and I respectfully request your approval.
Thank you, Marie. I have a motion from Regent Carter. Do I have a second?
Kathy.
Second from Regent McAdoo. Any questions or comments on the proposal?
I have a comment, Chair. I think this is important for us as a system to be examining programs from each of our institutions collectively as a system, so we're not doing this on an ad hoc basis. I understand the need for this program here today, but I don't think this is the way that as a system we should be moving forward in the future. I think we have to examine all of our institutions, determine which institution is best suited to provide the program or the programs that are needed in the state. And we don't do this in response to crises like we have in the present case. I think we need to be more forward-looking. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions or comments, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously.
Thank you.
We will now go to item. That's me, technical difficulties. We'll now go to item number 11, 2018-19 NISHI sponsored funding report. Marcy.
My name is Marcy Jackson, and I am the Executive Director of the NSHE System Sponsored Programs and EBSCOR Office. And I'm here today to give you highlights from the 2018-2019 Sponsored Programs Report, which is included in your materials. I wanted to explain a little bit about our office and this report before we get into it. The NSHE System Sponsored Programs and EBSCOR Office helps facilitate collaboration on large statewide and multi-institution grants that include the National Science Foundation and NASA EBSCOR research programs, as well as the NASA Space Grant and Gear Up program, which are education-based. We work directly with the sponsored programs at each of the institutions, and we also work with faculty throughout the state. This report is a compilation of all of the extramural funding that our institutions have brought in fiscal year 19. Extramural funding is grants, contracts, cooperative agreements, and other funding mechanisms from state government, federal government, foundations, industry partners. The report gives you, the regents, one source of information for sponsor programs for the system as a whole, and it highlights the research funding across the system, including our two R1 institutions. Sponsor funding programs help us meet all of the strategic goals for NSHE. Everyone thinks of research first, which is very important to us, and we're very happy that our UNLV and UNR have their R1 status and they're raising Nevada's overall research profile. But sponsor programs also help with access, including the achievement gap, through programs for low-income and first-generation students. And I forgot to say, next slide, please. Also for the success goal, we have student services for tutoring and counseling. And on workforce, we work with industry partners for certificate and training programs. Next slide, please. So this graph shows our overall funding that we've received from 2016 to 2019. If you look at some of the past reports, you'll see that these numbers are lower than they used to be. And that's because in 2016, we took out the Title IX financial aid funding because it wasn't really sponsored program. Next year, we will have a five-year baseline, and so 5 years of data. So I think we'll just make that a footnote and we won't have to talk about it as much anymore. But if you see here, our institutions have been steadily increasing the amount of funding that they have brought in over the past 4 years, with over $40 million increase, and $22 million of that being between fiscal year 18 and 19. Next slide, please. This pie chart shows the total funding each institution received in fiscal year 19 from external sources. We'll dive more into those numbers as we look at each institution. But it's important to note on the right side there that we received 51% of our funding was direct federal funding. This shows that our institutions are being competitive on the national level. It's also interesting to note that the research is 61% of all of our sponsor programs that we receive. Next slide. So we'll touch base with each of the institutions, and these slides have a lot of numbers on them. I'm not gonna read through all of the numbers. I'm gonna give you some background information. But each of the funding courses that we receive are categorized by industry standards, research, instruction, student services. If you'd like more information about what falls into these categories, you can review Appendix G. So for UNLV, their School of Medicine has increased their awards by $7.4 million during this period, with funding from the National Institutes of Health, as well as Health and Human Resources Administration, and the Governor's Office of Science and Innovation and Technology. Although there was an overall decrease in awards of funding from fiscal year 18, they did get an increase of approximately $2.1 million from state funding for projects such as increasing critical care surgery fellowships and a GOED project called the Sports Research and Innovation Initiative, designed to generate new products and services in the sports field and bring new companies to Nevada to help diversify the economy. Next slide, please. UNR had an increase of $30 million in awards this year, with a 20% increase in research. UNR Med also had an increase of 12% in expenditures. New projects included the Center for Biomedical Research Excellence, a COBRE award, about regulating the cardiovascular system in health and disease. And there's a new NSF project called CREATE, which has curricular and co-curricular activities designed to retain and graduate engineering students. And also working with the Corps of Engineers, UNR is exploring a new paradigm for managing threatening and endangered species. Next slide, please. DRI saw an increase of 4% in awards from $30.4 million in fiscal year 18 to $31.8 in fiscal year 19. The largest gains were made in funding from state and local government, private for-profits, private nonprofits, and federal pass-through awards. An NIH project has a collaboration with UNR and DRI on the effect of wildfires and prescribed burns on the cardiovascular and respiratory system's health outcomes. An NSF-funded project is researching how to identify microorganisms that metabolize environmental contaminants such as microplastics. Next slide, please. NSC had an increase of awards of 26% with a 25% increase in federal awards, which were mostly from the U.S. Department of Education. NSC partnered with DRI and CSN on Nevada's GeoGateway program to substantially increase the number and diversity of students graduating from NSC's geoscience degrees. NSC also had 5 students successfully complete the Teach Nevada Scholarship program that you've heard about before. And they all met their teaching license requirements and are accepted or ready to accept positions in the K-12 within the state, but throughout the state. Next slide, please. CSN had an overall decrease of 9% in awards. They did receive funding from the Governor's Office of Science, Innovation, and Technology to address commonly identified barriers to STEM degrees for underrepresented and low-income students and interventions to overcome those barriers. They received funding from the Federal Health and Human Services SAMHSA department for a project to train employees to know when to refer students to counseling service. And they remain active with the NASA Space Grant program with multiple projects. Next. GBC had an overall increase of $1.2 million in awards in the instruction category. Funding from GOED allowed the diesel technology program to expand to Ely, as well as paid for some tuition in 2019. And OWEN funded the resumption of the commercial driver's license training program in Elko. DBC also received a Perkins Award to provide training equipment and supplies for the diagnostic medical sonography post-associate certificate in Elko. Next slide. TMCC showed an overall decrease of 47% in awards, but that is due to a large multi-year awards they received in 2018. You see the $7 million there. They got all of the money up front, so that's why there's such a fluctuation. The National Institutes of Health EMBRE program continues to support hands-on research opportunities for students, and they have 2 OWEN grants that continue to serve populations that have barriers to re-entry to the workforce. Next slide, please. WNC had a decrease of 11% in awards. The National Institute's EMBRE and NASA Space Grant programs provided on-hand research activities for the students. The Career Connection program continues to provide services, as well as a new program called CREST, which is working to remove barriers for students with disabilities. They also, as part of the sponsored programs, work on the Sierra Nevada Lavender and Honey Festival, which was attended by 1,500 people, or I'm sorry, 15,000 people last year. Next slide, please. This slide shows the interinstitutional collaborations among artists. It's the sub-awards that they have given to each other because they're working on a project together. Last year, there were 89 of these collaborations, and this year we're 122. As I noted at the beginning of this discussion, the NCSPO EPSCoR office, our function is to work on collaborative projects and statewide projects. And so that's why the number four are off so high for those levels. That's the function of our office. Next slide, please. This table shows the number of proposals submitted and received in fiscal year 19. The total may not match Appendix A exactly due to award times or announcement of intent to fund. For the record, the table on the slide deck, as well as page 11 and Appendix B in the full report, have been updated to reflect the most up-to-date grants and contracts received and total amount awarded. Corrected versions are going to be available on the ARSA minutes and the NCHE website. So for the record, the changes to this table are UNR revised total number of grants and contracts received is 657, with a total amount awarded of $141,509,348. NSC's revised total amount is $1,204,183, and TMCC revised amount total awarded is $3,684,096. The overall total is 1,210 received and, 244,915,000 total award amount. This slide shows the state program match funds. Excuse me. These funds are received from the state to provide match on federal projects, such as the NSF EPSCoR, NASA EPSCoR, Space Grant, and Gear Up programs, with a small percentage going to the infrastructure of the EPSCoR office. The percentage that each of the institutions receive year to year varies because these funds are mostly for competitive projects, such as seed grants, fellowships, and scholarships. Because of the timing of the EPSCoR year 19, state sub-awards were delayed. So there's a 1.7 pending when we did this report with the end date of June 30th, but by August, another 444,000 had been subawarded to the institute.
And Marcy, what slide are you on now? That was slide 15.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I'm actually at the end.
Okay.
So we had a total of 246.7 million in funding that was received by our institution for fiscal year 19, and I'm open for any questions.
And Marcy, you said that would be all those updated numbers would be up on the website. Can you make sure that the board
yes,
gets
notice? They'll be included in the ARSA minutes as well.
As soon as the website's updated, if we could get a message out to the board so they can see those numbers, that'd be helpful.
Yes, certainly.
Any questions or comments from the board? I do like that slide that we added in a few years ago, Marcy, with showing how the institutions are working together and doing grants together. It really shows the emphasis of a system and partnering up within the system based on specific needs. And thank you. This was information only. I'm hearing no other questions or comments. So with that, we will go to item number 12, new business. Do any regents have any new business? Hearing none, we will go to item number 13, public comment. Winner, did we receive any during the meeting?
Nope.
Sorry, Regent Carter, I missed you there. Was that on the previous presentation?
Yes, if you don't mind.
Yeah, no, go ahead. We'll go back to item 11, Regent Carter.
Okay, I'm looking at page.
Hi guys, if you already finished.
Let me find it here. I think it's page 17.
Thanks again.
Okay, so it has the amounts of money that were granted from each government organization. Do we have a count of what different government organizations we applied to in this last year? Because there's seemingly a lot of areas where we didn't apply for anything or receive money, at least.
The institutions would have that information. The proposals that are submitted, they each have their own tracking system. So if you'd like to see that, I can request that information to see where they're actually submitting.
I think it would be somewhat interesting to see just which areas we're not maybe applying for grant opportunities that we could be. Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Now we will go back to item number 13, public comment. We've received no public comment during the meeting, so this committee stands adjourned.